to the Code Newbie podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about DigitalOcean, one of our incredible sponsors. They've got simple cloud hosting built for developers. And for all the Code Newbies who just started learning to code, yes, that means you, they've got one-click solutions for Rails, Django, Node, and much more, so you can launch your app in no time. And if you're looking for full control of your server, they've got that too. And you can use the promo code CODENEWBIE to get a $10 credit, so check them out. We're also supported by Dev Bootcamp. They are an immersive coding school that takes you from beginner to full stack developer in just 19 weeks. They've got campuses in New York City, Chicago, and San Francisco. The next cohorts start June 8th and July 6th. You can apply now by going to devbootcamp.com, so check them out. So we talk a lot about coding on the show. After all, it is called Code Newbie, but I wanted to look into the business side of code a bit. So today I am so excited to have Andrew Chen on the show. He is an investor and advisor to many tech startups, including Dropbox, AngelList, and Product Hunt. You know, no big deal. Andrew, you want to say hi?
How's it going? Glad to be on.
So glad to have you. I'm so excited. So I hear the word tech advisor thrown out a lot. What does it mean to be a tech advisor?
Yes, there's a huge spectrum. But, you know, typically what advisor is for a startup is somebody who's, helping a startup because they have a very specific set of skills. Usually it tends to be really narrow. Maybe it's around fundraising. In my case, it's around growth and metrics and marketing and sort of that side of things. And then they typically take a small amount of equity in the company and are involved over, 2 or 3 years kind of in the initial formation of the company in order to help the entrepreneur. And it's a great job because, it's one of these things that, it's totally part-time. And you basically can just be the cheerleader and really, help the entrepreneur without having like the potentially weird investor dynamics of being, an owner in the company as well. So it's a great way just to support the entrepreneurs.
I feel like you get the best of both worlds because you get stake in the company, just a little bit. You have skin in the game, but not to the point where, your money's entirely on the line and you can be the support system, the cheerleader, and all that fun stuff.
That's right. Yeah. You end up with an equity stake that's sort of like equivalent to being an employee. Typically, it's lower than 1%. Typically, and it's going to vest over the course of a year. But yeah, I mean, it's really great. It's very easy to go in and contribute in really specific ways. And it's all about, supporting entrepreneurs. And when you get to start to work with a lot of different companies in the ecosystem, what you can see is that, there's a lot of different ways to help them.
So at this point, at least, you're a pretty big name. You're very well respected in the startup tech world. How do you decide who to advise?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So in the early days, so I've been writing my blog now almost, I think it's like eight or nine years. So it's been
a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I originally started when I was working in venture capital at a firm called More David Au Ventures, and they manage about $2 billion in capital on Sand Hill Road. And so, back in the day, believe it or not, venture capitalists did not actually write any blogs and Twitter didn't exist at the time. And so, whereas it seems like these days, that's basically all they do is write blogs and tweet at each other. At that time, the sort of idea was that, I think like Dave Hornick from August Capital was maybe, writing a VC blog, and that was about it. So I was like, oh, this is really great. I'm going to just start writing about cool things that I'm learning. So what ended up happening was I was just writing a lot, and naturally startups would start to reach out to me to pick my brain about different topics that I was writing about. And again, my background was more or less around customer acquisition and marketing and growth and metrics. And so most of the questions that I was getting was around that. So in the early days, I was actually not very picky at all. So basically, if I met a startup and they seemed like they were smart folks, then I would just say, sure, like, yeah, I'll be an advisor. Like, why not? And that was great. I think over time, what's happened is, now there's enough opportunities and there's just a lot of startups. I think that's on one side of things. The other side of things is that, it turns out that at least for customer acquisition and growth, it's not something that you actually need to focus on right away. The most important thing in the early days is just to really validate the market. So that's getting your first product out, that's doing, you know, user research. And so, you know, in a lot of cases, that's not about scaling growth and metrics. And so I typically, you know, now over time have waited, you know, a bit further to the point where maybe there's some funding in the company, maybe there's an initial customer base. And I start to focus on, you know, at that point in order to get involved, you know, with the company. So a good example is Product Hunt. You know, with Ryan Hoover, I've known him for years when he was, you know, just arrived in the Bay Area. And for him, you know, for Product Hunt, what was great was that he had actually built a mailing list in the early days and was just, you know, sending out cool products on his mailing list. And he was able to gather a group of people who, you know, who were super interested in that. And so by the time that he actually had gotten, you know, producthunt.com, or actually I think it was .co, you know, initially built out, it was pretty clear that it was going to work. And there was like a couple thousand people who were interested in seeing these new products. And so then it's a lot easier for somebody with, you know, with my background to come in and say, okay, now that you've done the really hard part of actually coming up with the idea and like, you know, getting the initial customer base, you know, now I'm going to help you, you know, think about raising money, you know, think about growing the mailing list. What are some partnerships you might be able to do and that kind of thing.
So that's a really good example. For Ryan Hoover, was having known him for so many years, was that a big part of your decision to advise his startup? Like if he was just, you know, an average guy you never heard of before with a Product Hunt idea, would it have been the same for you?
Yeah, I think it definitely helps. But I think that he got Product Hunt to the point where, you know, the product also just spoke for itself. You know, it was clearly working. There was a lot of excitement about it. So I think, you know, it actually often happens that I'll meet an entrepreneur, you know, over the course of, you know, for a coffee. And, you know, within a month, I'm exchanging, you know, very regular emails with them. And, oh, wow. You know, and, you know, I have some kind of a relationship, you know, going. So I really, you know, I really let the product speak for itself, because I think one of the most amazing things about Silicon Valley is that you see great companies coming from folks of, you know, all sorts of different backgrounds. That's one of my favorite parts.
So when you are looking at a product and you're trying to see if it's worth your time, is it about traction? Is it about a clear business model? Is it about interesting technology? Like, what are some of the things that really stand out to you and grab your attention?
Yeah, it could be the honest answer is that it depends. I think that, you know, certain things that like traction, like engagement, are things that are super important, super interesting, and you know, as soon as you see it, you know, it's definitely working. And there are cases where, you know, going back to Product Hunt again, you know, where just the amount of excitement around that service and how many entrepreneurs, you know, how many emails I get from people saying, hey, do you know someone at Product Hunt? Like, you know, can you get my product submitted? You know, it's just very clearly, you know, that they're solving this really important problem of getting new products out to a big audience. So, you know, that can be a big thing, but, you know, at the same time, it's definitely true, that, you know, when I see, you know, company doing, you know, working on a really interesting piece of technology. So, you know, this might be, you know, in the SaaS world, for example, I'm involved with a company that went through Y Combinator called Front, and they basically make it easy for the shared email addresses, like sales at, you know, domain or support at domain. For a whole bunch of people within the company to have an email client where they can all work out of that, you know, work out of that. And so for something like that, I was actually super, super impressed that they had actually gone and built a native, you know, Mac OS client and a Windows client. And they were really thinking about native apps, you know, in order to do that. And they were solving a real, you know, problem as well. So I think it really depends. But I think what you're really looking for is you're looking for that, you know, one really special part of the product that, you know, convinces you that there's something special and that they have an insight that other folks in the market don't have.
So you are not a developer by trade, correct?
Yeah. So my undergrad was in applied math. And so I took 2 years of computer science doing that. And then when I was in college, all my internships were in software engineering. So for a little while, I was writing Perl and Java, And, you know, and that was great. But as soon as I left college, I was like, okay, I'm just going to go on to the business side. So my first job out of school was working in venture capital.
Really? Wait, why did you decide that? Why did you decide technology wasn't for you, or like the development of technology wasn't for you?
Yeah. You know, in a lot of ways, I actually miss it. And I actually do still write code from time to time. These days, I'll, you know, sometimes throw down some Ruby to like, you know, parse some data that I'm interested in. So I still do it from time to time. But I think, you know, what I found was that the part that really attracted me to products was actually more around the design of products and the experience and some of the business aspects of, you know, how to grow and market products. And I just found myself more excited about that than some of the hard technology problems that I know that a lot of other folks get like super excited about. So, you know, in my computer science classes, I would meet folks who were, you know, for example, super excited about operating systems and, you know, how file systems worked. And I just didn't have that level of passion on those topics compared to, you know, I've always been really interested in how, you know, how taking a product and how describing that product differently, you know, is so compelling, or how, you know, how people sell, you know, a product like bottled water, something that's very ubiquitous, but people are willing to actually pay like a couple bucks, you know, for bottled water. Like, I find that kind of thing and sort of the human psychology around that super, super fascinating.
We had a very long, heated debate on the CodeNavi Slack community last night about K-cups and how expensive they are compared to just making coffee. And it just upsets me to no end. Just like the laziness tax that we're willing to pay is just, it's incredible.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And in a lot of those cases, you know, you're not paying for the actual product. You're paying for, you know, the convenience, or you're paying for, you know, keeping your employees happy. Right. And so, you know, those services are a whole, you know, different thing. But, you know, I do love the technical aspects of products. And so I find myself drawn to, you know, problems where you actually bring both the technology side and, you know, and product design together. So like, I love, you know, products that have a lot to do with analytics or have to do a lot with, you know, big data. And sort of marketing automation, you know, those are all things that are really tough, both data problems, technical problems, as well as, you know, having really smart, you know, business issues in there as well.
Well, let me just say, if you ever want to pair on some Ruby, I got you.
Nice. Nice. I'm sure I'll need the help.
So tell me about how different your perspectives, your advice, maybe even your career would be if you didn't have that technical background.
Yeah, I mean, well, so first I should definitely talk about my first job out of school, because it completely changed my life, and I wouldn't have gotten it without, you know, without a technical, you know, background. So, so like I mentioned, you know, I basically in my senior year of university, I went to University of Washington. I did applied math there. With an econ focus. And I was originally thinking about working in finance. But the more time I'd interned at startups, the more excited I was about doing that. And, it, you know, within the startups, people would always tell me about like, oh, yeah, you know, our venture capitalist said XYZ. And I was like, oh, who are these guys? How come they have a say? And so I was really interested in this. And, you know, I was 19 at the time. And so, you know, so what happened was I had a professor named Emer Dooley, changed my life forever. And what she did was she said, oh, you know, when you graduate, instead of going to, you know, Microsoft or Amazon or one of these things in Seattle, you should maybe, you know, work in venture capital. And so she introduced me to a number of different VCs in town, about 10 of them over email. And of course, you know, I followed up and, you know, like I said, I was 19 years old. I didn't have anything to offer, basically. and so, you know, 8 of those VCs politely just said like, no, thanks. And so More David Ventures was really interesting because they actually had 4 partners in Seattle at the time. They've since closed that office, but actually none of the partners there were technical. And so it turned out that my in there was that I was actually significantly more technical than the business folks that were working in that office. And so what I offered to do was, you know, I ended up having a meeting with one of the partners there, and my pitch to them was, you know, hey, like, you're going to have some, you know, routine technical questions to ask. You're going to want some research done on some of the, you know, new companies that are coming in. And so because of that, You know, let me do that for you, right? And I'm familiar enough with these concepts that I can, you know, I can search for that kind of stuff myself. Or worst case, I can, you know, I can ask folks in my network. I can ask my professors, you know, on their opinions. And so, you know, the funny part of the story was that actually after I had that meeting, I was like, I felt really good about it. And then they just never called me back. And they didn't call me back. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to keep calling them. So I ended up actually trying to follow up and get a second meeting with them. And I called them every week for 3 months.
Good for you.
Yeah. And I was like buddies with the, you know, with the head general partner's office manager. And at one point I asked the professor that introduced this, I was like, you know, it's been like 6 weeks or so that I've been calling, like, am I just getting blown off? Should I just stop? And she said, no, these are just like really important people. And, you know, if they wanted to say no, they, you know, to a student, they would have no problem. They would just say no, right? There's no reason. And so, you know, I kept calling, and yeah, 3 months in, I got a second meeting, and they were like, oh, sorry, you know, we were closing $50 million worth of deals. So we were a little busy.
You know, no big deal.
No big deal. Yeah. And so they were like, you know, what do you want? Do you want money? Like, do you want to just come in? And I was like, yes, just give me a desk. Like, I'll just figure everything else out. And so that's how, at the age of 19, I started sitting in on like Series A pitches, at a venture capital firm. And again, it wouldn't have happened without, being technical, because that exactly became my job. I ended up, doing all the due diligence on these technology companies coming in and talking with customers and sort of putting together, you know, notes on how I thought, you know, how well the technology worked. And, you know, and I don't know if how much they read it or not, you know, but I was able to add hopefully a little bit of value to their analysis. So,
you know, I can't imagine evaluating a technical company without having a technical background. Or having someone on the team with a technical background. Like, that to me just intuitively doesn't make sense. How are they able to make decisions without you?
Yes. Yeah. I think that surprisingly, I had all these misconceptions about venture capital coming in, actually. Because I thought, you know, going in, oh, you know, there's going to be a bunch of like finance stuff in there, and it was going to be really quantitative, and they're going to be really detailed about it.
You know, what is it really like?
And totally, no, it's not like that at all. Not like that at all. I mean, a lot of the times, you know, it's people who are investing in folks, you know, with proven track records, right? So I know that, you know, sitting in a VC firm, maybe you get on the order of several thousand pitches emailed in over the course of like, you know, a quarter, let's say, or, you know, it's probably even more than that, right? I mean, you end up spending your days actually, you know, just meeting after meeting after meeting. I have, you know, one really funny anecdote I have about VCs is that oftentimes you'll meet with a VC for breakfast and they'll have like one, like a half piece of toast and like a couple, like little couple bits of fruit. And you're like, wow, are you on a diet? Like, what's going on? And they're like, no. I have three back-to-back breakfast meetings. And so I'm eating my breakfast in one thirds, right? And so that's just how they do it. So they're just like really busy, like hearing these pitches all the time. And so because of that, what's happened is, you know, they end up investing a lot on reputation and whether or not this product has been shipped already. Now, that said, the other thing I'll say is that investors these days expect that the product's been built. And they don't want to fund things where, you know, they don't want to put in $500K or $1 million into something where the product, you know, hasn't been coded or where there's nobody, you know, on the team that's going to build it. And the reason for that is because technology's changed so much since the late 90s versus now where, you know, now with like AWS and Rails and, you know, all this open source software, the expectation is that coding something up and actually building the product is not the hard part. That's not the part where you're going to fail. The part that where you're going to fail is like not actually getting your users and not actually solving a problem for users. Versus in the late 90s, you know, you could raise $5 million on a PowerPoint deck because just the process of building the V1 of the product, you know, might take like 18 months to 2 years and might take like several dozen people because they actually have to rewrite all the components of everything.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. Also, I think the real lesson there is that all meetings should be over food.
It's so much more casual. They just want everything to be casual. That's right. That's right.
So I think that there are a lot of people in, you know, who are listening in the Code Newbie community who are learning to code but have different skills and different backgrounds or coming from different industries outside of technology. And a lot of them are interested in building a product, hoping to turn it into a business, maybe not to the point where it's investable, maybe it's just a lifestyle business. What advice do you have for that kind of group of people who are getting those skills so they can build their own stuff, but don't necessarily come from a tech background?
I think, you know, one of the most interesting things about, you know, about how where the risk is in a business these days is that it's moved towards, you know, what investors, you know, call market risk, right? Just, you know, whether or not there's a real market there, whether or not people can buy it. And I think the most interesting thing about that is there's actually a lot to be said for trying to validate and chip away at that market risk, even without building a lot of, you know, without building a lot of product in the first place. So, you know, it's surprisingly easy, for example, to, you know, build, you know, famously, you know, Eric Ries's, you know, suggestions around like landing pages, right? And, you know, and you can do so much with WordPress, you know, these days, and just sort of glomming together a bunch of plugins, or building a mailing list of people who are really interested, or building a Facebook or an Instagram, or a YouTube channel that shows that there's a lot of people interested. And there's a really wide class of products, especially, you know, in cases where you're selling, you know, where you're selling this stuff, you know, something physical where you're making money right away, where an approach like that really makes sense. And in that case, you know, being technical will really help you in understanding like how to actually, you know, stitch some of these tools together, but you may not have to write the entire product from scratch, right? Now, if you just like really, really love to build something and you want to build something completely custom and, you know, sell it, then I think, you know, one of the big questions, you know, in terms of bootstrapping then becomes, okay, well, that's great. But then you're going to need to make money, you know, pretty quickly right off the bat. And so I think that's why when you look at the, you know, 37 signals kind of philosophy, you know, that tends to lend itself towards selling towards businesses. So building SaaS and B2B products that have a high ticket price, so that you can sell into businesses, you can do content marketing, do your blogging, and you don't really have to, you know, build a huge, huge customer base in order to start breaking even. So I think those are two considerations I would think about.
Yeah. So for the startups that you invest in and you advise, do they generally start with something like a WordPress, or, you know, forking a different repo with similar functionality? Like, is that usually what you see?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, yeah, a couple of the startups I'm involved in did really start that way. And quite a few of them did not start that way. So it goes both ways. So AngelList actually originally was created as a mailing list. It was literally a mailing list where Naval and Nivi would hear about really great companies. And they would just email these great companies off to, you know, some of their favorite angels to get a company funded. And so literally that's why it was called AngelList. And then after they showed that that could work and they were getting deals funded, then it became easy to, you know, then go ahead and, you know, just build a website around that. You know, Product Hunt, we also talked about, did, you know, basically that. There's a company called Wanilo, which is sort of like a, you know, competes in the same space as Pinterest. So it's sort of shopping discovery. And I've been an advisor there since it was, you know, one female founder and her a CTO who's based in India. So, you know, really early days. And so for that, you know, one of the key decisions was actually to create and build up a really popular Facebook page. And so she eventually had gotten a Facebook page with millions of likes, and she was buying ads, you know, for people to like her page. And that was what drove the initial traffic into her website, which was definitely in the early days getting a lot less traffic than her Facebook page. Yeah, so I think, you know, so those are some examples where they, you know, a few companies were able to use something smaller, like a Facebook page or a mailing list, you know, or a blog, in order to bootstrap the rest of the business. Now, compare that to, for example, my friend Drew at Dropbox, where I'm an advisor and I've spent a couple hours a month with them. You know, they built that completely custom because there's no other way that they could have been able to execute that business. Yeah, because that's the whole point, right? There's no, you know, okay. But that said, one of the earliest things that they did, and, you know, something that you guys can, you know, listeners can check out, is that one of the first moves was they had built a waiting list for Dropbox where they had a little video to describe, you know, what the product would do. And you could sign up. And within the first day, they had 500,000, you know, the first couple of days, I think they had, you know, 500,000, you know, emails. So validating that there was people interested, and then they were able to, you know, then finish up the product and then release it to that group. So I think there's always something, you know, between the idea and actually building it and coding it up, there's always a lot of gradations in the middle for what you can do to validate the idea more. And I think that, you know, when you get really excited about coding, it's easy to skip some of those steps. So it's mm-hmm. it's good to combine both approaches.
So when you talk about building up a Facebook page or WordPress or something that, you know, is off the shelf, do you mean just using it to validate the idea and then going off and building a custom thing? Or does that become kind of a permanent solution?
Yeah, I think you can choose. I think you can choose. Sometimes, you know, to fully realize what the product, you know, ought to be, you do have to rewrite the whole thing, you know, and it could just be a launching pad. And sometimes it turns out that, you know, you can build great companies, you know, basically using WordPress, you know, and it's pretty surprising. But, you know, I mean, WordPress is great because it's PHP and there are so many different, you know, you can build your own plugins, you can heavily modify it. You know, so there's a lot that you can do with WordPress in particular.
So I got into coding because I wanted to build my own products and I wanted to know what that was like. And as I learned to code, I fell in love with just code as the product itself, right? Writing mm-hmm. beautiful code that was clean, easy to manage, easy to extend. And one thing that I find conflicting is there seems to be kind of a disagreement between good code as a product and the code that you need to build an MVP, right? Like the MVP mm-hmm. code is generally not very good. The you know, the goal isn't to make it good. The goal is just to kind of get it out. So as a new developer, or maybe just as a developer in general, how do you reconcile those two goals when you're the one that's actually building the product?
Yeah. People definitely have different philosophies on it. And I think that there is a high degree of, you know, craftsmanship that, you know, one of the great stories of, you know, of Steve Jobs and Walter Isaacson's biography of him is that, you know, is how much he obsessed with making the motherboard and the circuits, you know, within the original Macintosh actually aesthetically pleasant, like the layout of the chips, right? And, you know, you would think like maybe nobody cares about that, right? You know, nobody's going to look inside of the computers, but he cared. And so I think there's something with, you know, and maybe it's more a correlation than causation that the folks who really do care about, you know, the craftsmanship of, you know, every bit of code and every little feature, that is able to extend itself all the way out into the external, you know, design and look and feel of the product. You know, maybe. I think that, you know, historically, it's also true that I was just actually having a conversation with one of the investors behind Uber and Pinterest and a couple of these. And, you know, he was joking that a bunch of recent companies have all been created by like not very good programmers. Right. and that what ends up happening is, you know, when you look at like the early history of Twitter or you look at the early history of Pinterest and Uber even, you know, that these are not like the best programmers in the world coming in and building these products and scaling them. That instead you kind of have an initial team that is really great at exploring the ideas and sort of throwing together, you know, kind of a bunch of features and iterating and so on. And then eventually once the, you know, product actually is successful and, you know, brand for the company is being built, that you end up hiring in, you know, folks who are, you know, much, much stronger engineers who go through and rewrite the whole thing to be, you know, the quality of code that you expect. Maybe, but, you know, but you know, and Facebook would be another one, right? Because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, of course, was famously a psychology major and he was hacking, you know, PHP. You know, and had, you know, and I think when he was like 18 or 19, you could kind of hire him off of one of these like rent-a-coder websites to build your website before he built Facebook. So I think that, you know, there's a history of both. But, you know, also you can look at something like Dropbox, where the two co-founders were both, you know, MIT computer science guys, and they built great code from the very beginning And you know, and it has just worked the whole time. You know, so that's a great model too.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. So I think that gives a lot of people hope that they don't have to be, you know, the senior engineer to start thinking of their product and building their product as a startup.
That's right. And I have a question for you, actually, which is, you know, for this podcast and, you know, your work doing it, how much code have you written for it versus how much of the work is in kind of non-coding parts?
Every tech part of Code Newbie I built except for the forum. So the forum is just using Discourse, which I just put on a Linode server and let it do its thing. It's probably the smartest decision I ever made.
Yeah, versus trying to build it. Trying to build a forum software yourself, right? That would be totally crazy.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That'd be way too much. But you know, the good thing about, so for me, I started the CodeNewbie, it's a Rails app, and I started it, you know, about a year ago, and I was using it as an excuse to practice Rails and practice coding, build up my product development skills, and also use something that was needed. If I were to kind of start over again now, I don't know if I would jump right into a Rails app. I'd probably do a Squarespace site or something very simple and then kind of see what my needs were and then maybe build a Rails app when needed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think if you're executing a podcast or you're building out, you know, I could see this, what you're doing, you know, turn into like some kind of an ed tech company, you know, over time. And a lot of those things are, kind of like they're e-commerce, you know, it's kind of an e-commerce product and there's a lot of different solutions out there. Now, over time, if you wanted to like build a lot more community features and social features into the product, you know, and profiles and sort of have that extend to every, you know, sort of nook and cranny of the experience, then then maybe you'd go all custom. But I find in the early days, you know, it may not be necessary because it's really the content, you know, for a podcast at least, it's the content that really stands by itself.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that for me is just very uncomfortable. You know, so we recently, about a couple months ago, launched our Slack community. And obviously, I did not build that at all. And, you know, it's super busy. We have, you know, a great community there, lots of conversation. And it's great from a product business perspective because I didn't have to do anything. You know, I monitor and, you know, I comment and engage, but I don't have to worry about the tech. But as a developer, it's very unsettling. You know, like I want to say like, yeah, I built that and that's my stuff and I can't really do that. So I'm just trying to get over that.
Well, I always have the, you know, have the thought that, you know, if you're one of these hardware engineers, right? Or you've been working in operating systems and then you encounter, you know, web engineers, you probably just feel like, like these guys don't know anything. Like they don't know what actually happens when like you actually click on a button, like what's actually happening at the hardware level, right? And so, these guys are like hacks basically, right? And it, maybe it's the same way that my dad feels like, you know, the fact that I don't know anything about cars makes me, you know, less of a guy, you know, than he is because like for my car, like, you know, you open up the hood and it's like coated in plastic and just has a logo. When you think about it that way, I think the reality is that everybody's always building off of other people's, you know, code and ideas and, you know, and once you're comfortable with that, then you're maybe like, maybe I don't have to write all the stuff.
Yeah. I'm definitely letting my, like, the logic drive the decision and not my feelings of, like, not my ego. I'm not letting my ego make the decision, which is helpful.
Nice.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about your blog, because blogging is something that we talk about a lot in the CodeNewbie community. It's, especially as a new developer, when you may not have a great track record of, you know, products and code bases that are really impressive, just saying, you know, here's my blog and here are the things I like to talk about and what I'm learning can be, you know, a deal breaker for getting a job and not getting a job. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about some of your blogging practices. You've been doing it for 8-9 years. What is your schedule? What's your process? What's that like?
Yeah, no, it's great. I've been writing my blog for 8 or 9 years. In the early, the first year is always the hardest because at that point, you know, I decided to start it once I moved to the Bay Area. And for the first year, I think literally 25 people maybe read my blog. For the first year. And it was like my mom and, you know, a couple of my friends like from Seattle. And that was it. And, you know, I was writing a lot, but I wasn't getting, you know, very much traction with it. And I was sort of writing about anything, you know, just whatever I got excited about, I would do it. So in the early days, I was writing about like, childhood like nerd memories about me using computers to like business things, to like explaining how certain, I'd worked in ad tech online ads before. And so I would explain some, esoteric concepts, over there. And yeah, what I found is that, it takes a while to find your voice. And I think the most important thing, and the thing that I actually end up recommending that people do, is to really optimize for, for frequency, to pick a topic where you feel like you have a lot to say over a long period of time. One of the most common, things that I see people do is they sort of like have a book that they want to write. And so they're like, all right, I'm going to write like these like three blog posts. They're all going to be super, super long. And then they're going to burn themselves out like right away. And so that's what they do. And especially, when that's your very first one, that's going to be the least appreciated thing because, frankly, nobody's reading it at that period of time. And so over the course of 8 or 9 years, I haven't really taken it that seriously. I think more recently I've been more serious with it, but I've built an audience that's probably around, it's maybe like 100,000 email and RSS subscribers, something like that.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, which is pretty good. And, I have a lot of Twitter followers or whatever. So that's fun. But yeah, I mean, I think, some of the best practices I think about now is, in terms of starting a new professional blog, I think the first thing is that, is to optimize for frequency. It really becomes a representation of yourself over time. Mm-hmm. So, whatever you're excited about, and conversations that you're having, just write them down. You don't have to go and write about like some new, amazing new idea that you've heard. Like instead, I encourage people to think of themselves more like they're journalists, right? They're covering things that, that have been said, or they have like some commentary on, or maybe they're even just gathering a bunch of articles and links that they think are interesting, right? And to have a much more freeform perspective as to the kinds of content, that they're going to publish, and that it doesn't have to be just their own stuff and all big ideas only. And I think what that does is that frees you up quite a bit, because then you find yourself, just like occasionally being struck by, a really great article you read or something that your friend said or something that you read at a conference, or maybe you're just taking notes at a conference and you're publishing it. And so just building that frequency up, I think is really important. And I think externally it's really great because, there's been now cases where maybe I'll meet somebody like once or twice ever and in person, and and then they end up reading my blog, and then a year later or 2 years later I end up meeting up with them again, and they feel like they really know me, and the kind of conversation and the kind of relationship that I can have with somebody like that is amazingly elevated, where then if I wanted to invest in their startup, or I had some ideas for what they would do, they would be much more open to it. Just because they feel like they know me, because they've been getting emails from me, every day, every week for a year or two, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think of that as one of the, really great benefits of writing a blog. And then I think how to market your blog is that I end up actually spending about 50% of my brain power, for a given piece on the title, actually, just by itself. Yeah. I think lot about the title and how, why somebody would click on the title and why they would share the title. And so maybe I'll drill into that a little bit. And then I think a lot about after I write this essay, who's going to distribute it? Like, why does anybody care? Where am I going to put it? Am I going to put it in Hacker News? Am I going to share it out on Twitter and people are going to like it? Am I going to maybe pitch some journalist friends that I know to try to publish it somewhere? So I think a lot about that. And try to make sure that, I have a plan for how I'm going to get a piece of content out there, not just write the content and then sort of in a super introverted way, just sit there and just complain that nobody's reading my stuff. So on the title, a lot of what I think about is that, we're kind of all aware of the really horrible, like clickbait, titles that are kind of like, that BuzzFeed sort of, quote unquote innovated. that are like, this thing happened and then you'll never guess what happened next, right? And you have to click.
I always click them though.
Yeah, exactly. I click them too, totally right? Work. Yeah, they totally work. And so I think there's an interesting thing that's like, yeah, those totally work, but at the same time, they're so cheesy. And like, what are some versions of that that aren't that cheesy? So I think a lot about, like, for example, I just wrote one, in fact, that is where the title is photos of the women who programmed the ENIAC, coded the Apollo 11 software, and designed the original Mac, right? And so that title actually is really great because you don't actually know, like, you can't actually look at the photos by just reading the title, right? Mm-hmm. You have to actually click on the link in order to view the photos. And so the title hints at some content, and then to experience the content, you have to actually engage with it. So that would be one example. Another example might be, I write a lot of titles that say something like, why, you know, this, right? So, or like how to calculate this metric, right? And those are really great too, because again, they hint that there's an underlying longer discussion, like how to calculate cost of acquisition, for mobile installs. You know, that's something that, like, if you're interested in that topic, like, you're going to click on it because, you know, it's not like you can just read the headline and absorb all the information. Mm-hmm. So I try to make sure that each of my titles actually, you know, really does express, you know, something that makes it click-worthy. And then what I've actually come to start doing is I've actually come to start just testing out my titles just by tweeting them.
Oh.
So I'll tweet something like, so probably the best essay I've ever, the most popular essay I've ever written is an essay called Growth Hacker is the New VP Marketing. Mm-hmm. And that actually just started. Yeah. And so that actually, just that one essay is more popular than the rest of all my content combined, for example.
Wow.
And yeah, which is amazing, right? And I basically wrote it on a fluke. And the reason why the title happened was that I actually had tweeted exactly that, Growth Hacker is the New VP Marketing. And it got so many retweets and so many favorites that I was like, okay, if I write a blog post that just happens to have that as the title, people will also tweet, you know, will also retweet and favorite it. And that's what I did.
Interesting. So you didn't actually write the article. You just tweeted just the title.
Just the title. Yeah. And then I decided to expand on it. Mm-hmm. I decided to expand on it, once that started to happen.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Yeah. And so over time, I've now started to do that with a very substantial portion, of my essays. I'll tweet the titles first and then, and then just expand on it later. And actually I did another one that was really interesting where I took, there's a guy named Joshua Porter, and his Twitter handle is Bacardo. And he actually wrote a really great tweet that was really popular. It was called The Next Feature Fallacy. The fallacy that the next feature you add will suddenly make people want to use the entire product. It's so great. So that that got like 700 retweets. Okay. Wow. And so I looked at that and I was like, oh, that's really great. You know, I've been testing my own titles for blog posts. I should just use other people's tweets for my titles. So that's what I did. So I I featured his tweet at the very top. So he actually thanked me. He was like, oh, this is so awesome that you did this. I totally, quote unquote, borrowed his tweet as my title. And it completely worked. It was like amazing. I had over 1,500 shares of this essay within the first 24 hours. So that gives you a sense of, why that technique works. So yeah, Twitter is a really important channel for me now. And then I'm just trying to build email and RSS subscribers over time just to build kind of a relationship with the people who read my content.
So it sounds like everything you do around your blog is very purposeful, even from the beginning.
Yeah, I think in the first year, it was not purposeful. I think I would just write because I thought it was fun. And prior to that, I had actually had two other blogs where I had started them and written them for a while, and they'd actually gotten a little bit of traffic, and then I just deleted them. I don't know why, but that's just what I did. And then before that, when I was a teenager, I would actually write, quite a bit in terms of just like personal journals. And I really enjoyed that also. So I just actually just love writing. And then, you know, it just turns out that writing when people actually appreciate what you write is way more fun than just writing by yourself and deleting it once you get frustrated.
Yeah, I think it's really great that you weren't discouraged, or at least discouraged enough to stop writing from the very beginning. Because I think that, you know, when you, especially if you put a lot of work into your blog post and nobody reads it, it's, you know, just your mom kind of, you know, emailing it out to her friends and that's it. It can be, you know, not very encouraging.
Yeah. And I think what you have to do is, and maybe this is where going, tying this back to kind of like code craftsmanship, right? You know, some of the same feelings, which are that, you know, I think that's why in the early days you have to write because you're just proud of what you're writing.
Yes.
And you just have to have an intrinsic, you know, get intrinsic value out of it. And then also when you write and then let's say like literally one person, you know, says, hey, like this is really great that you actually take that and you're like, all right, you know, like
one
person read it and they really liked it and actually like be satisfied with that versus I think if you go into it being like, oh, well, you know, Andrew has like 100,000 readers and that's going to take me like 8 years to get there.
Yeah.
Then it's like, yeah, maybe then you'll be unhappy the whole time, you know, and you'll never get there. But that's part of the fun is actually just having, deriving intrinsic happiness, you know, from your writing or from making anything really. And so, you know, maybe that is code. Like maybe you write a piece of code that, you know, web app that you think is just really great and it solves a little problem for you and maybe a couple of your friends. And I think that's how a lot of this, like a lot of these great products start is, you know, thinking about these things as small problems without the pressure of like, hey, how am I going to turn this into this big thing and get investors and all this other stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So let's move on to some fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
I am, yes.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
Yeah, so the one that I thought was really funny, and I'm glad that I rejected it, but it came from very credible people. It came from a lot of credible people. Was actually early in my career when I was thinking about, you know, whether or not I should stay technical and, you know, continue to be a software engineer, or you know, or what kind of career I should have. That there's sort of this idea that, you know, the advice that I got was, you know, you should go work at a big company. The local big companies in Seattle were, you know, Amazon and Microsoft, you know, certainly, and, you know, go get some experience. And then once you're in your late 20s, early 30s, then you'll have the experience to go start a company. And I think that, you know, there's a guy, Randy Commissar, who's a partner at Kleiner Perkins. He writes a great book, you know, where he talks about, you know, where he talks about the deferred life plan and how a lot of people, there are things that they want to do with their life and they just keep deferring it. And they think that they need more preparation or they need more credentials or they need to get a certificate somewhere or they need a big fancy school behind them before they can do the thing. And I just don't believe that. And so I think what's really great, I think, within especially folks who are teaching themselves how to code is that, you know, there's just a great spirit there, you know, to just go and do it. And that's, I definitely really believe that. And I think that that is advice that I got and luckily hope did not follow, but that I think most people who are either thinking about switching careers or starting a new career, they often feel like there's so much preparation that they need to do before they're ready to go do something else.
The deferred life plan. I never heard that before. I love that.
Yeah. So no, it's from a book called The Monk and the Riddle. It was written in the late 90s by, you know, this partner at Kleiner Perkins. And before that, he had been at Apple. He'd been in, you know, a bunch of other companies. And he, that book, The Monk and the Riddle, is such a great book because it's just about the psychology of being an entrepreneur and startups. It's not at all about like minimum viable products and like, you know, here's how you like, you know, think about raising money and here's Series A preferred, like all that kind of stuff. Like he doesn't talk about any of that. He just talks about, you know, starting new companies, starting new products and how that ties into your personal like life journey. So it's definitely, it's a little bit more touchy-feely, but it's literally one of the only ones that where you read it and I think everybody is gonna, you know, end up nodding their heads to it.
So I agree with the general sentiment of you're probably ready, or if you're not, it doesn't matter, you should probably start now anyway. But are there situations where it does make sense to wait, you know, and to get more skills and to, you know, see or just wait a little while and wait till you're ready? And how do you know when that's the better option?
Yeah, I think that it makes sense when when what you're trying to do is very specialized and there is just a tradition of very you know a tradition of qualifications and certification that go into it. So like, if you're going to be a lawyer, like you obviously can't skip law school. Like you need to take the bar, right? Like you do need to do that, right? Obviously. And there are jobs in the tech industry that are like that. I mean, if you're going to do, if you're going to design, you know, chips for Intel, you do need a hard computer science, you know, software engineering, computer engineering kind of background, and maybe graduate school, you know, in order to like really make that work out. But, you know, I think for the vast majority of things that we're talking about, where people are trying to defer starting companies, or they feel like, you know, they want to, you know, they want to get a job, you know, break into the tech industry, you know, you would just be surprised. I mean, I always think about it as like, hey, you know what, like one of the reasons why the Bay Area is such a great meritocracy is that they really do hand out checks to like 20-year-olds. Right. And, you know, what does a 20-year-old know that, you know, somebody who maybe has had a career somewhere else and is breaking the tech industry, you know, I think they're on equal footing.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because I feel like handing checks to a 20-year-old doesn't really sound very meritocratic. Is that the word?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It sounds like you didn't actually do anything. So what exactly did you earn at that point?
No, but that's the interesting thing is that there's, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, in terms of like, oh, I guess we're going to talk about this next actually, is that, you know, there's way more kids that are programming these days because you have the internet and like people can just like, they can just teach themselves stuff. And so by the time that you're 20, like maybe you've actually built like four or five major apps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, you know, you can actually imagine that there are lots of 20-year-olds out there, you know, like the Snapchat founders or like, you know, the Facebook guys or whatever, where they have really been able to build something substantial, you know, at that age. And so I don't think that there's anything that keeps somebody who's later on in their career from doing that, except that oftentimes, you know, there's sort of this idea that, you know, oh, well, you know, I should actually go back to school and I should, you know, go major in computer science and do all this stuff. And I just mm-hmm. don't know that that's necessary.
Yeah, makes sense. So when you decided to not get a software engineering job at 19 and instead started looking at VCs in business, did you feel like you had wasted your time in school studying computer science and math, at least before you got your first job?
No, not at all. Yeah, I think actually, if anything, because there's so much respect for engineers, you know, in the industry, I think that, you know, when you start out on the engineering side, you can always switch to the business side pretty much whenever you want. And I think most people, most companies and most situations, like there's no worry about that versus the going from business into suddenly coding is definitely much harder. Yeah. So I've heard of that as a test of like, you know, which discipline is more superior to the other is whether or not you can switch from one to the next. So yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, in terms of, you know, so I think that like, it's actually very plausible for folks to, you know, be on the engineering side for the first like 5 or maybe even 10 years of their career and then switch into being more on the business side. And that's like totally, totally viable. I think that's great.
Number 2, my first app was about.
Yeah. So, my dad did a PhD in civil engineering. And so I would actually come with him to his computer lab when I was like 9 or 10 years old. And I have all these like weird memories of, you know, using the internet for very trivial things, like looking up like lists of jokes, as a 9 or 10 year old using
the
internet.
That's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Pre-web though. Right. So I was using like Gopher and like, Archie and Veronica were like the search engines anyway. So that was really great. So I actually ended up learning how to program, partly to do that. And so my first like, totally joke app was an app called, it was coded in, Microsoft's GW Basic, which was one of their mm-hmm. first products. And this is in DOS. And so I, you know, again, I was a kid. I wrote a program called Andrew's World, and it was created merely to taunt my sister. There was no other purpose for it. And so it would just have a list of questions like, you know, who's the smartest person in the household, like that kind of stuff. And you would just have to type, you just have to type my name over and over again. And so I would just get her, I would like, oh, I built a program for you. And like, you know, she could never type her own name. If it typed her own name, it would say that you're wrong. And it would just repeat. I don't know if she remembers that. Yeah. Well, you know, for a little while, it was pretty frustrating. Okay. Pretty frustrating.
I was gonna say.
Yeah.
And that so could have lasted very long.
And so now she's actually VP marketing at SurveyMonkey. So she's also in tech at this point. So maybe my early exposure her early exposure to tech via my programming helped her experience technology early. Okay. So anyway, so that was my first like kind of joke, stupid app. And then my actual real one was in fifth grade. So this would have been, I guess, 11 years old, 12 years old. Anyway, this was also done in BASIC. We had this whole class about probability, and one of the teachers, who was a really great teacher named Kent Daniels, in the Seattle School District, he said, maybe one of you guys wants to, make a program that, simulates, rolling two or three, dice, and adding up, what all the dice say, and then building a distribution curve. Right. And so, because you kind of derive the theoretical probabilities of like how to get to each number when you roll like two or three dice, but now do that and simulate it and roll the dice like 10,000 times. And so I was like, oh, that's like pretty cool. So I was like, I will try that. And so so I was like so proud of myself because, I like learned, I actually had to write a function to like roll the dice and like understand like pseudo random number generators and like, it was, basic program, but it was like, it was so great for being like, 11 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
This was my project. So I ended up working on it with like two friends of mine, and I did most of the work, and then I'll just claim credit for this. And then we ran it. We put it on a disk, and, we announced it one morning in class, and we put it into this old Mac Plus, and we loaded it up and we started running it. And then we're like, cool, we'll like check this in like a week and see what happens. And then we started the class normally. And about 30 minutes into the class, the Mac actually overheated and it started smoking. And so all the smoke started coming out of this. Yeah. So the teacher was like, so I think the computer doesn't like your program, Andrew. And and so we had to evacuate the class. And, wow. And then that was the end of that experiment. But yeah, it was a fun, that was my first like thing that I ever wrote.
I think that is the best, my first app story we've had so far.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to add one other thing to that story.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
go for it.
Yeah. So I actually, I wrote up that story on my blog. This is a couple of years ago. And amazingly enough, Kent Daniels, the teacher that was in that class, actually emailed me. And we had like a couple, couple emails like back and forth, and and so I told him I was working in Silicon Valley and all that stuff, and so it was like just a great follow up. Again, great reason to write your blog. If you mention people's names, when they Google for themselves, then they'll find it.
Yeah. Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is.
Yeah. So early in my career, what I really struggled with was the idea that I had this preconceived notion of what it was like to be a software engineer and build software all day and to do the coding part. And so I sort of felt like, okay, great. It's going to be this like pretty introverted activity. And, I'm just going to sort of stare at my computer all the time and not talk to anybody. And, what I realized many years later, now that I've been in the industry, that is actually like totally the opposite. And that it's actually, very social. There's so much teamwork. And that the process of coding is really like, using a paintbrush. Like it absolutely matters, like understanding the techniques and, the history and, how other people are doing it and how you can always do better. That's always really important. But especially when you're talking about the tech industry and like new products, that there's so many other pieces of what it's like to actually build something. For example, around design and psychology and entrepreneurship and business. And all of that in the end is still expressed primarily through coding, and that the folks who are especially early stage, startups, that you actually get to experience a whole lot of, the beginning and end of building a new product. And it's not just this sort of introverted thing where you're sitting by yourself, coding along. So I think that I definitely, wish that I had sort of understood, what it was like to be a software engineer earlier in my career. And I think that would have probably kept me more excited about staying technical and coding, for much longer. And I think that is, in fact, probably something where if more people sort of understood that, like in high school or in early college, that we would have way more computer science majors.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So next, let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Yes, I do. So I'm going to recommend a couple of my favorite books. So one of the new ones that I've read is called The Innovators by Walter Isaacson. And Walter Isaacson also wrote the famous Steve Jobs biography that was sort of like the official one that right after he passed. And The Innovators
that book is actually the reason why I got into tech.
Oh, is it? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Why is that? Tell me why that motivated you to get into tech.
Yeah. So before that, when I thought of computer science and engineering, I definitely didn't think it was for someone like me, for race and gender reasons, but more so because I always consider myself to be very like liberal artsy and like a talker and a writer and those kinds of things. And I never thought that that had a place in coding. And then when I read that book, here's this guy who wasn't very nice, but at the same time, he was very designy and artsy and loved a lot of things and cared about a lot of things that I did. And I thought, maybe there's a place for like a liberal artsy type of person in tech. And then that was how I started looking into it and exploring it and eventually made the jump.
That's great. So The Innovators is his follow-up book, and it's not about a single person. Instead, it zooms out, and it's sort of the opposite. It zooms out, and it talks about how innovation is actually really, really messy, and it's typically not one person. It's like teams of people, you know, building on each other's ideas. So that in itself is really interesting because, you know, by the time that the media usually gets a hold of a new company or a new piece of technology, they usually want to find like the one and then usually guy who actually is in charge of, you know, coming up with the idea. They want to give all the credit to one person. And so what The Innovators is about is the idea that actually you can see how many different ideas kind of spontaneously emerge at the same time and how people like rip each other off or, you know, they derive their ideas from other people and how no idea is really that original. But then, you know, one other little thing I'll add about it is that The Innovators also opens and ends with the story of Ada Lovelace, who's a, 19th century lady mathematician, and how she actually came up with the first algorithm and the first notion of a loop and speculated about, you know, artificial intelligence and all that other stuff actually before the first computers, were ever built. And so it talks about that. It talks about some of the women that were involved in building the ENIAC, the first all-electronic general purpose computer, as well as, you know, Grace Hopper, who, came up with the word debugging and bugs. And she was, you know, really important in the field of compiler design. So I thought it was a really great, sort of cross-section of history and shows a lot of different backgrounds of the kinds of people who are involved in tech versus these days. I think, you know, for good reason, the media ends up primarily emphasizing, you know, 20-something year olds wearing hoodies like the kind that we see in HBO Silicon Valley. And and we don't see this sort of, you know, breadth of different experiences and diverse backgrounds that have actually contributed to technology over time. So that's one book that I'll shout out. Mm-hmm. The second one that I really liked, I'll give a briefer bio, version of this one, but it's called Code, The Hidden Language of Computer Hardware and Software. And it's by a guy named Charles Petzold, and it's published by Microsoft Press. And so this book is really great because it actually talks about so as a software guy, I basically just deal with the software part. Like I actually basically don't know anything about hardware. There's that famous interview question where you ask people like, when you type in, on Google search and you click the mouse button, describe in as much detail at the software, hardware, and network level as what actually happens. And so that's like a great interview question because it shows like, you know, sort of if somebody's very software oriented, maybe they could tell you about, you know, what's actually happening, you know, on the website and HTTP and all that other stuff, but they maybe wouldn't be able to tell you about like, you know, DNS or about like search infrastructure or something like that. And a hardware person would even be able to tell you like, you know, what's actually happening at the deep hardware level, like how a mouse click actually happens and how that, you know, bubbles its way up into the operating system level. So anyway, so Code is actually about mostly the hardware side. So what it actually starts with is the idea of logic gates and it basically starts with just that and then builds its way all the way up into like how those turn into circuits and then how those circuits, you know, and input devices like actually build into a computer. And then it goes all the way up. And then the last chapter is just about programming. And so it really gives like a lot of background. It fills in a lot of detail, a lot of really interesting detail at a high level, you know, on the hardware side, which is like background that I personally do not have. So I find that really interesting. And then the last book I'll recommend is The Design of Everyday Things, which is by Donald Norman. And this is a really classic book about design. And, you know, he coins a lot of really interesting, you know, terms in it. But a lot of the book is about how design is not how something looks, but it's actually how it works. And he describes a lot of, everything from like, you know, teapots and how a teapot's handle sort of invites you and lets you know it sort of quote unquote has the affordances to invite you to like grab the teapot there and pour it. And it shows you some, and he shows you photos of some like kind of evil teapots that don't work and they have affordances in the wrong direction. No. And those are really great photos. And then all the way talking into like software and, you know, those kinds of products. And so I think, you know, that's the kind of thing where like, obviously, regardless of how clean your code is, if you build code where users like don't actually understand how to interact with your product, then it's
kind of a problem.
Irrelevant. Yeah, exactly. And so I think of that as sort of a great example of, you know, one of the classic books that is more about, you know, what software is meant to do in terms of shaping somebody's experiences versus like how it runs.
So I have a couple of shout outs of my own. The first two are sponsored shout outs. DigitalOcean's offering the Code Newbie community a chance to try their cloud hosting service. Use the promo code CodeNewbie and get a $10 credit to get your app up and running. They've got easy one-click solutions for Rails, Django, and much more. And if you do try it out, let me know. I'd love to know what you think. If you're looking for an immersive learn-to-code experience, check out Dev Bootcamp. It's a 19-week program that is perfect for code newbies like you and also people with some coding experience. You can join a small cohort and learn with motivated peers from experienced instructors. And they've got full-time career coaches to help you get job ready. New cohorts start every 3 weeks. To learn more, go to devbootcamp.com/events and attend an info session or schedule a tour. You can actually see their space and talk to some of the teachers. And I've got a few personal shout outs. One of them is actually a list of books from you, Andrew, called 10 Classic Books That Define Tech. And what I like about this list is a lot of them are a little bit older, which I think was on purpose. You picked books that stood the test of time and that, you know, were around for a little bit more. So if you're looking to learn about tech, not just from the coding side, but also from the design perspective and the product perspective and the business side, this is a nice collection of books that has all of those different fields and angles of tech. So definitely check that out. There's also a GIF that I really like. Andrew, have you seen this? It was on Twitter a while ago, called What It Looks Like When Users Try to Use Your Product.
I don't think I saw that.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Oh my goodness. It's so funny. It's basically, I don't know where the clip is from. It's from like some cartoon or something, but it's basically a picture of, or a cartoon of this guy trying to drink from a cup and he doesn't know what to do with it. And so he like puts his mouth on the bottom and he tries to like nudge it over and he just does it completely wrong. And for you, the product owner, it's totally obvious how you're supposed to use the product. So I think a lot of people who are trying out their products and giving it to users for the first time will definitely appreciate that gift. And my final shout out is a blog post from TechCrunch called Etsy CTO on its conservatively crafty tech philosophy. And I really, really like this blog post a lot, especially given our conversation today. And it interviews the Etsy CEO, Kellen Elliott McCrae, if I'm saying that correctly. And he talks about the Etsy process, how they pick technology, how they're not very quick to acquire or to, you know, kind of add in new technology into their stack. They kind of take their time and they're very cautious. But I thought it was a really interesting way to talk about tech at that level and at that scale, and definitely worth a read. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for #CodeNewbie and tweet with us every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Andrew, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.